welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan, Sudan, and the rest of the region this Friday, October 11th, 2024. One Sudanese refugee staying at a Juba mosque says he's got nowhere to go after being ousted.
In my case, to leave the mosque premises within these 3 days, it is impossible for me to transport all my property.
And a new UNICEF report released on this International Day of the Girl Child says 1 in 8 women say they were sexually assaulted as kids.
These numbers are actually lower than the actual prevalence. Why? Because we know that only a small proportion of victims actually talk about what they've been going through.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The Islamic community has been evicting Sudanese refugees who have been sleeping in mosques and elsewhere on their grounds. The moves come after a refugee allegedly hacked to death a muezzin at a Juba mosque. But some refugees say they have not been given enough time to find new places to live. For VOA News, Dennis Lagagne reports from Juba.
The Islamic community became alarmed after a Sudanese refugee was accused of killing a muezzin last month at Juba's Nimra Talata Mosque. The suspect had been living at the mosque compound but allegedly had caused trouble and had been forced out. He allegedly killed Sheikh Musa Abakar Mulu, the cleric who led the call to prayers, with a panga. The South Sudan government and Islamic leaders have ordered refugees who sleep at mosques to leave immediately. Many of the refugees have fled Sudan's war. One Sudanese man, only identified as a sheikh, lives with his family at a mosque. He says he was given just 3 days to find a new place, and that wasn't enough time.
There is an order that has come from government and mosque management that only 3 people should be residing within the mosque premises, such as local security guards, preachers, and the imam. In my case, to leave the mosque premises within these 3 days, it is impossible for me to transport all my property and my family. At least if they would give me 10 days, but no way. Yet I have been staying in this mosque for 14 years.
Munir Samid is the chairperson of the mosque management committee at Nimra Talata.
Those of the mosque, they did not know more about those who are coming because they are refugees, and they used to welcome them and to give them a place to sleep. And then in the morning, everyone is going out to look for something to work or to do so they can be able to eat and feed themselves. Then at night, they used to come and sleep.
Sheikh Juma Ali, a former presidential advisor on Islamic affairs, says about 30 Sudanese who had been sleeping at the Mahad Mosque have been placed under the care of refugee organizations.
Before 3 months or 4 months, we struggled to chase them away, especially in the Mahad Mosque, because they have been there more than 30 people or 40. When they come from Sudan, they say that we are refugees, and then we don't know how to go. Some of them, when they reach at Reng, and then from Reng, they say that we are gone, we have our relatives in Juba. And then those people there, they transfer them when they reach at the airport, nowhere to go. That is where they come to the mosque. And then later on, we negotiate with those responsible for the refugees. We talk to them, and then the last thing, we check them out from that mosque.
Dimba Shafiq is in charge of Muslim County Affairs in Central Equatoria State. He says his office and the Islamic Council are working together to relocate all those sleeping in mosques and guarantee their safety.
The Secretary General and my office in the County Affairs, we are working hand in hand to see that these people who are sleeping in the premises of the mosque are evacuated out. Inside the mosque, I don't think that the Muslims are sleeping inside, but within the premises, there are those who are sleeping there, and we shall make sure the only person who will be around the mosque premises is only the imam, the faraz, and the muezzin. Any person who has come to pray, he pray and go.
Police arrested the suspect in the killing of Sheikh Musa Bakar Mulu, and they are investigating the case. They have indicated the man may have mental health issues. For VOA News, I'm Dennis Lagagne reporting from Juba.
This week, the leader of Sudan's Rapid Support Forces, or the RSF militia, accused Egypt of supporting its opponent, the Sudanese military. Lieutenant General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, also known as Hemeti, said in a video message that the development marks an escalation of the conflict. Egypt has denied the accusations. Hussein Shingray is the Foreign Affairs Secretary of the People's Democratic Party of Sudan. He says Sudan, as a sovereign country, has the right to buy weapons from wherever it wants. Shingray tells VOA's James Buddy that Hemeti may be trying to blame his apparent defeat on other countries.
It's just an allegation, as you said, because even if you look at his speech, he talked about first, you know, Egypt supplied Sudan with different type of airplane. And then he come and talk again about that. The Egyptian, they use their own plane and pilots to strike Jebel Moya. Which one is right? They supply them with airplane or they did that by themselves. And I don't think Egypt is going to be involved in something like that because the Sudanese, they have many pilots, they have many airplanes. And even it's happened that, you know, Egypt supply them with the airplane, which is possible, could happen because this is a military. It's a country, they have their military, and they have the right to buy airplane or get airplane from anywhere. But I don't think right now Egypt is involved because they are, you know, holding a peace agreement negotiation and everything. They work as to get this war stopped.
But there is some evidence that Egypt has been supporting the Sudanese army.
If Egypt, they want to do that, they will do that first time when the war starts. Because at that time, they have the right to do that because you remember when the Hemeti took, you know, the hostage from Egyptian army in Marawi airport, while at that time they just have a training down there. At that time, if Egypt want to act, then they can act at that time. And they have the right to do that because their pilots have been taken from Marawi and they came for the training at that time before the war. I think he's trying just to drag, you know, many countries in this war and try to show the world that why he's being defeated. And he talked about the supplying the Sudanese army with weapons from Iran and from different countries. Okay, this is an army. Then what is about you, your militia? Who's supplying you? From where you get all those, you know, very developed weapons? Even the Sudanese army, when they compensate those weapons, they never see it before. They don't know how to use it even. Why we don't, you know, look at that instead of just looking at the Sudanese army? That's an army. They have the right to do that as the countries to defeat themselves.
We understand that Hemeti made this speech. It's a recorded speech. Do we know where he is right now?
If he is still alive, but what we think and what we saw, and most of the Sudanese, they think that he was dead. And what is happening now is just, you know, it's a kind of computer technology or all those things just to keep his army, you know, holding. Because if they know that he's being killed, then they will probably, they're going to leave the bottle war. But the only thing we can say out of this speech is he admitting that he is losing.
That is Hussein Shingray, Foreign Affairs Secretary of the People's Democratic Party of Sudan. He was speaking with my colleague, James Buddy. The first ever estimates on sexual violence during childhood show an alarming prevalence with devastating consequences for children. On this International Day of the Girl Child, UNICEF estimates that more than 370 million girls and women, or 1 in 8, experience rape or sexual assault before the age of 18. And the highest number of sexual assaults occur in sub-Saharan Africa. For more on this, I spoke with Catherine Poulton, UNICEF Child Protection Manager, and Claudia Kappa, UNICEF's Senior Advisor on Statistics.
In the case of sub-Saharan Africa specifically, because we are talking about an absolute number, the number is the combination of two factors, the population of this region and the risk of encountering or exposed to sexual violence. So the risk is high in sub-Saharan Africa, but it's also a region where there is a significant population of girls and boys and women and men. So that's the combination of the risk with the size of the population that gives these 79 million children. There are other regions, however, that have a smaller population, but the risk is much higher. So if we look at the prevalence estimate, Oceania, for example, has the highest risk. In that part of the world, 1 out of 3 adult women report experience of sexual assault or rape in childhood. So we need to look at both the absolute numbers as well as the prevalence, give us the risk.
A third of women are being sexually assaulted or raped.
A third of women have reported being raped or sexually assaulted in their childhood before they turned the age of 18. And we might expect that these numbers are actually lower than the actual prevalence. Why? Because we know that only a small proportion of victims actually talk about what they've been going through.
Why is that? Because of the stigma that's attached?
Of course. There are many different reasons. It's only a small proportion, approximately 1% of all victims who report their experience to an authority. But also we notice, and that's what we publish in the report, is that many victims don't talk about it at all with anybody, not with a friend, not with a family member. Why? There is stigma, of course. There is shame. Sometimes victims, unfortunately, get further victimized because they are not believed or because there is victim shaming going on. But there is also another important consideration, Carol, and it's the fact that many of these perpetrators are actually known by the victim. We are not talking about the rape of a stranger. We are talking about relationship. We are talking about friends and neighbors. We are talking about family members. So reporting and talking about it becomes extremely complex.
Let me bring in Catherine here. Catherine Poulton, you are the UNICEF Child Protection Manager. Why do the perpetrators of sexual violence in sub-Saharan and other places, why do they get away with it?
I think one is often the perpetrator is known, and it's a lot of responsibility to put on a child to report an adult that is known, maybe a parent, maybe a family member, maybe a friend. So there's a lot of fear. Often they've been threatened not to report. I think the other thing is, you know, in many parts of the world, there are no services to report. You know, if you look at many of these areas that we're talking about, including in wealthier countries, we don't have the number of services that are required to support this level of distress. And I think it's really important to notice we need more funding and more resources to respond to this. You know, you can't expect children to know automatically where to go, to feel safe to report it, especially in areas of conflict where we see the numbers are even higher than where there is no conflict.
There's a big spike, according to this data, between the ages of 14 and 17, the ones who are abused. Why are girls of this age targeted? And who are we? You've alluded to it, but who are we talking about? Are there abusers?
Adolescent is a period of vulnerability because of many reasons, right? The first one is this is when girls and boys start having relationship. They might start dating and they might have expanded friendship and relationship more broadly, right? There is transformation of the body. There are expectations about complying with what is expected of them within the context of a relationship, within the context of friendship. There are also a lot of forms of violence that are normalized.
That is Catherine Poulton, UNICEF Child Protection Manager, speaking earlier, and Claudia Kappa, UNICEF's Senior Advisor on Statistics. Both were speaking to me earlier from New York. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up on South Sudan in Focus, after the Africa-China summit in Beijing, does Africa have agency in China's concept of the New World Order? Find out when we come back. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. As attention moves toward putting into play resolutions from the recent Africa-China summit in Beijing, questions are being raised about whether African countries have the agency to shape the relationship going forward. In his new report, Reimagining African Agency in Africa-China Relations, Paul Nantulia, senior researcher at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, tells me in part one of our conversation that there is an imbalance of power, with China pretty much running the show.
China's Global Security Initiative is one of its new national security concepts that was put in place under Xi Jinping to basically articulate a vision of global security that is rooted in Chinese official paradigms. It talks about things like non-interference in internal affairs. It talks about things like collective security among China and its partners. It talks about a vision of an alternative system of international arrangements that conform to China's governance concepts. So it's a new initiative, and this Forum for China-Africa Cooperation articulates it very, very clearly. The stepped-up military and security package under the new China-Africa strategic plan that takes the relationship out to 2027, those packages are described as the early stage implementation of the Global Security Initiative. China has been looking for allies in the developing countries of the Global South, of which the African continent is the largest bloc, to support and legitimize those concepts.
Yeah, and one of the things that you said that's in this GSI, you said early on, non-interference in internal affairs, like that's one of the benchmarks or something in this plan. What does that mean exactly for African countries?
Well, for African countries, it means that whatever relations they're able to build with China, whether it's economic, whether it's the procurement of military hardware, regardless, there are no strings attached. China does not insinuate itself into internal affairs of African countries in terms of how they are governed, whether it's an authoritarian government. That doesn't matter. You know, China engages across the board, sells weapons to countries across the board, builds relationships with countries across the board, economic, cultural, political. And this is something that African countries, quite a number of times, African leaders say that they prefer that kind of relationship because obviously they do not have to account, you know, when they're dealing with China, they don't have to account for things like human rights violations. They don't have to account for things like that, right? So China is engaging across the board, and any country is able to secure whatever it wants from the People's Republic of China. That's one of the things that has made, it's a central plank of Chinese foreign policy, but it's not altruistic. It is strategic in the sense that it allows China to position itself as a preferred partner.
That is Paul Nantulia. He's senior researcher at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, and he was speaking to me in Washington today. On Monday, Nantulia talks about whether African leaders are willing to go along with China's plan in order to get what they want. Kenya's national airline is producing diesel fuel made from plastic waste. Authorities say the goal is to provide cheaper fuel and to reduce plastic waste pollution. Victoria Amunga reports from Nairobi.
Uncontrolled disposal of plastics in Kenya often increases pollution and waste in the environment. Most of this plastic ends up in landfills. However, this month, National Airline Kenya Airways launched a project to turn plastics to fuel. The plastics are shredded and loaded into this hopper. Heat breaks the plastics down into oil, which is refined into diesel fuel for ground vehicles. The company's chief operating officer, George Kamal, says at least 1,000 liters of fuel is produced daily.
We get people to work here in the plant, and we get people to work in the community to collect that plastic from the community and pays money as well for the community. So we take that waste plastic from the community around, and we use that. So 98% comes from the community around us. 2% comes from the airline.
Scientists say the diesel produced from plastic waste is less efficient than regular fuel, produces higher exhaust emissions, and has lower flash point, meaning it catches on fire more easily. At the same time, oil supplies and prices are chronically uncertain, and Kenya barely produces any crude oil. So experts say creating fuel alternatives is crucial. Patrick Obath is an energy consultant in Kenya.
You begin to change people to renewable energy and then also cut the dependency on the traditional hydrocarbon fuels. And the earlier you do it, the better it will be for the country.
Also, plastic pollution remains a significant problem in Kenya, despite recent national commitments to increase recycling. An estimated 92% of Kenya's plastic is mismanaged and only 7% is recycled, according to a recent report. Helen Mathuka is Kenya Airways Strategy and Innovations Chief Officer.
We do use the plastics that is in terms of bottles and other like trays and such like things. So when they break, would be forced to dispose them. But now with the plant, we are able to bring them back here and recycle the same to produce diesel.
The diesel production plant was designed by Kenyan engineers and is the first of its kind in the country. Kenya Airways officials say producing fuel locally is saving costs and reducing plastic waste. Victoria Amunga, VOA News, Nairobi.
Trade and maritime traffic between Cameroon and Nigeria nosedived this week after a Cameroonian state governor ordered a temporary trade ban. The governor acted to protest the abduction of two officials from Cameroon's Bakassi Peninsula. Officials say the kidnappers are Nigerian merchants refusing to pay taxes in the Cameroon-controlled peninsula. Moki Edwin Kinseka reports from Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé.
Business has come to a standstill in the Bakassi Peninsula near the Central African state's southern border with Nigeria. About 35% of Nigerian petroleum products and basic commodities imported by Cameroon pass through the peninsula, according to Cameroon officials. Nigeria also depends on Bakassi for most of its cocoa and fish imports from Cameroon. Aboko Patrick is the mayor of Kombo Abedimo, a locality in Bakassi. He tells VOA that several thousand merchants have been unable to transport their goods out of Bakassi since Wednesday.
All petroleum products come from Nigeria. Even food items come from Nigeria. The fish which is caught in our territorial waters is carried to Nigeria. Today, those fishermen, those who are doing legal business, we are bound to suffer, but this suffering can lead us to have peace. I think it's better that we go through it.
On Wednesday, Bernard Okalia Bilai, governor of Cameroon's southwest region, ordered the suspension of trade and maritime activity with Nigeria in the peninsula. Bilai says he ordered the ban because suspected gunmen from Nigeria recently abducted Roland Ewane, the divisional officer or DO of the Idabato district.
It is well established that the DO was kidnapped with the complicity of the population of Idabato, who are 95% Nigerian, who refuse to pay taxes and wants the DO want to fight illegal activities and to request the payment of taxes. He has attacked, kidnapped, and carried to Nigeria. It's well established that he's now in Nigerian territory. They should release the DO.
Ewane was abducted alongside Ismail Etongo, an Idabato District Council staff member, and taken to Nigeria in a speedboat, Bilai said. After a long legal battle in international courts, Nigeria ceded control of Bakassi to Cameroon in the early 2000s. But Cameroon has complained that most of the area's 300,000 inhabitants, most of whom are Nigerians, refuse to pay taxes. Merchants say Cameroon has deployed troops to enforce tax payments, something that Cameroon officials deny. Cameroon says it has written to Nigerian authorities to help secure the release of the two abducted officials. Joseph Vincent Tuda Ebode is an expert on international security at the University of Yaoundé, SUA. Speaking to VOA by telephone, he says it would be helpful if merchants paid taxes to the Cameroonian government.
C'est la frontière entre deux pays et les deux pays lorsque ils mettent ensemble.
Ebode says it is a civic duty for all civilians to pay their taxes, without which development would be very slow. He says Bakassi needs schools, hospitals, markets and lots of other infrastructure that can be developed with taxes. The trade ban appears to be having an impact as Nigerian merchants say they have not received goods from Bakassi for the past 2 days. Nigeria has not commented on the abductions or the ban on trade. Moki Edwin Kinzuka, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Well, it's that time of the week again when we hear from you, our listeners, on what you think about breaking developments and our coverage of the news. Here's VOA's Jackson Mbunganyi. Take it away, Jackson.
I am Ton Mamour Maket in Juba. I wish the Ministry of Labour, Trade Union and Civil Society stand up and fight for the rights of government employees in South Sudan who are made poor and disadvantaged in the society. How can they go for almost a year without salaries and you are keeping quiet? Raise your voices, please. I'm James Ruel Majok from Unity State in Mayom County. I'm appealing to World Health Organization and its partners to intervene quickly to rescue people of Mayom County from snake bites. Since flooding submerged some areas within Mayom County, currently there are many cases from snake bites due to flooding, where people are moving up and down within the flooding areas. And the worst scenario, Mayom County itself lacks health agencies who can support people of Mayom County. It's a big challenge for everyone because there's no health facilities for everyone in Mayom. Hello, VOA. I am Akol Mark Deng from Nimole Town. Akol Kur is not yet jobless. He still has a chance of becoming chief of staff in Bilpam. Salva Kiir Mayardit is looking for the good solution, not problematic. Hello, Voice of America. Thank you for airing my view on South Sudan in Focus. My name is Aligo Joel in Arua City, Uganda. The top leadership of South Sudan can accept changing of its lower leadership seasonally, and he refused to granting himself changes. One day changes will change him, whether being political, social, economical. We need reconciliation and peace for peaceful coexistence once and for all. Thomas Kuhn Torch in Old Fang Payam, Fangak County, Jonglei State. Hello, VOA, South Sudan in Focus. The appointment of Lieutenant General Akol Kul as Warap State Governor and Riek Biem as Unity State Governor will reduce the habitual border cross cattle raiding between two states. The reshuffling is a normal routine worldwide, and overstayed in one position for more than 10 years is unfair. Bravo, bravo, His Excellency, Country President. Good evening, South Sudan in Focus. I'm Jacob Dior Machweng, Rumbek Lake State. I wonder how the Minister of Humanitarian Affairs and Disaster Management missed to include counties of Lake State, especially Rumbek East County, that are affected by floods. Does it need connections too, or the selection of affected counties was done on random space? I am Peter Gok Anyang Manjogdul in Jonglei State town of Bior. Fighting corruption beginning when government officials stayed in top expensive hotel on government bills. So to avoid this, the authority concerned have discouraged this habit and used the funds to do other developmental activities like roads and electricity.
Thank you, Jackson. And that wraps it up for us this Friday. We invite you to head over to voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you somehow missed the beginning of this broadcast, just check out www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. We now leave you with the song Melange by Extra Musica. We've been listening to Melange by Extra Musica. I'm your host, Carol Van Damme in Washington. On behalf of our engineer, Tian Wong, and producer extraordinaire, Kwame Afori, have a peaceful weekend. And thanks for making us a part of your day. Join us on Monday for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from The Voice of America.